Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Ross, Judge Harris, Judge Jessen, the Honorable Kevin Ross presiding.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to this Court of Appeals panel Zoom hearing November 19th, 2024. We have three cases on our calendar this morning for oral argument and then two non-oral cases. The first matter on the calendar this morning is in the matter of the civil commitment of Bruce Fairbanks. Counsel, each of you will have 15 minutes to present your argument with an additional 5 minutes to appellant's counsel if you'd like to use that time for a rebuttal. The timing restriction should be somewhere on your screen, depending on how you have your Zoom technology configured, but do be mindful of the restrictions. Even though we can see each other today by Zoom, we're only making an audio recording of the presentation and discussion. So please do state your name as you commence each leg of the argument for the benefit of whoever in the public might want to listen to this later on, and so you can be attached to your argument. And with that, the only other thing I'll say is that so far we haven't had any technological issues. If we do, if you fail to see or hear someone along the way, any of the judges or opposing counsel, just alert us and we'll try to pause so that we can catch the technology up to us. All right, counsel for appellant, whenever you are ready to proceed, you have the floor.
Your Honor, this is Joshua Knuckles. I'm the attorney for Bruce Fairbanks, the appellant in this case. I'm arguing on his behalf regarding his SDP and SPP commitments. I'm challenging the grounds for both of those based upon the court's application of the facts to the law in those cases. I want to begin with an analogy that I think it would be helpful to address the main point that I'll be making here. For instance, if there were an individual who had two simple robbery convictions 25 to 30 years ago, and those simple robbery convictions for purposes of 253D.02 subdivision 8 would be qualifying offenses for purposes of a presumption of harmful sexual conduct if there's a finding of sexual motivation. Those two simple robbery offenses were resolved by that individual without any sort of sexual findings, sexual related findings made by the court in those cases. Taken alone, such convictions, it's my contention, would not be the basis for a finding by the court that there was a clear and convincing evidence of a course of conduct of harmful sexual conduct. Taken alone, isolated, I believe that there's not clear and convincing evidence that there's a course of harmful sexual conduct in those convictions.
Can I pause you there and just talk about harmful sexual conduct so I can understand your argument? Am I correct, taking these sort of one piece at a time, you're not disputing that your client's behavior, let's just focus on the exhibitionist behavior while incarcerated. I think there were 12 offenses of rather graphic behavior in front of female guards. You're not disputing that that conduct constitutes a course of conduct, correct?
Your Honor, I think, yes, in my brief, I wasn't arguing against the idea that there was a course, that there was a succession of events.
And am I correct that you're also not disputing that his conduct in each of those incidents was sexual conduct?
Your Honor, regarding the issues of the DOC infractions, the disciplinary violations within the DOC, I'm not disputing that there might have been some sexual aspect to them. What I am disputing is that they constitute clear and convincing evidence of harmful sexual conduct.
Well, let's just pause. I understand your argument. I just want to understand each piece of it. So you're not disputing that his exhibitionist behavior of exposing himself and masturbating in front of, specifically in front of female guards, was a course of sexual conduct.
I'm not disputing that.
All right. So the focus is whether it's harmful. That's really the heart of it. And you agree that you don't dispute that there was testimony that the district court received from the psychiatrist or the psychologist that the harm suffered, at least conceivably, could result in the sort of similar PTSD type harms that might be associated, I think, with other traumatic events.
What I am disputing regarding the DOC incidents is the fact that although, yes, there were examiners who removed from the situation are making statements about the impact potentially on victims. What we don't have any statements by the victims. We don't have any, we don't even have a real understanding of the processes in place in that institution of how they process those claims to determine whether or not we can actually determine that this has been proven by clear and convincing evidence. So the court.
Okay. So you're disputing that these events occurred, or you're disputing that it's harmful based upon clear and convincing evidence? What, I guess I want to understand your argument.
I'm disputing both aspects, considering the fact that there wasn't an understanding of how the processes were even implemented by the DOC.
So just so I understand you correctly, your view is that the district court, if the district court lacks some additional evidence of the processes that are used in prison to determine misconduct violations, that the district court is precluded from finding by clear and convincing evidence that those events occurred?
Yes, Your Honor, that is my position.
And what is your most persuasive authority, either statute or rule or case law, to support that theory?
The most persuasive authority that I'm appealing to would be the requirement that clear and convincing evidence is needed for this. And it's clear and convincing evidence.
Well, hold on.
You understand
we understand that clear and convincing evidence is necessary. My question is, you've asserted a premise of procedure, apparently, that the district court cannot find by clear and convincing evidence that conduct occurred unless the district court is aware, in this case, of how those findings were achieved or met. What were the procedures in the administrative tribunal of the prison? And I'm trying to understand whether you have legal authority to support that premise. I've never heard it before, so I'm assuming that you wouldn't assert it unless you found some case or statute or rule to support it.
I think the issue, how I am presenting it, is that the clear and convincing evidence regarding the nature of those events is not present. And the processes in place to actually determine the nature of them, which would include the impact upon victims, is not clear.
I just pause here. I mean, I'd like to get to the heart of your argument, which I think you're making right now, but I'd like you to answer the question that I've got for you. Is there any authority to support the idea that the district court is precluded from finding by clear and convincing evidence that an event occurred? I'm not talking about the harmful nature of one or the other, that the event occurred, unless the district court receives direct evidence or some other evidence of how the underlying tribunal, in this case, the administrative processes in a prison, are achieved. You're saying that the district court can't reach that conclusion. And I just want to understand, I give you one more chance to provide me any authority to support that idea.
Your Honor, I don't believe I have an authority regarding that issue of whether or not they can accept findings from the other tribunal. I think my issue that I've been trying to argue primarily has been the nature of those incidents and assessing their weight regarding the harmful nature of them.
Okay, so I just want to be clear then. So the heart of your argument is really the harmful nature, not the fact that they occurred.
Yes, Your Honor. For instance, I'm not arguing or contesting the fact that an assault in 1992 occurred, right? I'm not contesting the fact that there was a conviction in 2000 for kidnapping. Like, My argument is that to read back sexual motivation to such a level that it's harmful sexual conduct, it fails.
Thank you.
If I can, counsel, go back to those earlier incidents. I mean, as I understand it, you acknowledge that the 1997 incident, that would be, you know, an incident of harmful sexual conduct, right?
Yes, I'm not contesting that the first degree crim sex conviction.
Right. But what, and I just, one of the things I find it hard to understand is why the 1992 incident where your client, according, stabbed a young girl who I think has refused his advances, why that would not be another incident of harmful sexual conduct, which at least gets us down the road to, is there a course, right? So could you address the 1992, your position on the 1992 incident for me?
As the 1992 incident or the conviction. For second degree assault, that was resolved, but there wasn't findings related to sexual motivations. This is the court looking back and reading back into the record, essentially, these sexual motivations for that incident.
Well, and I don't understand why the court shouldn't be able to go back and look at the facts of that case, which, as I understand it, you're not arguing with me about this, I don't think, is that there was a young girl who refused his advances, correct?
I can't weigh on specifically other than exactly what my client pled in that case, or what was found by the district court in determining what were the factual basis for that conviction. As far as I know, there wasn't any findings by the court that there were sexual advances made as part of the conviction.
But counsel, was there any other either police reports or other collateral information that provided information that these advances were sexual in nature, that being that the impetus for the assault was the victim not accepting the advances of your client?
And that would go back to one of my main issues here, would be the court looking back at charging documents or police reports and letting that essentially fill out all the other details that they then accept for making a clear and convincing evidence finding, which I don't think is appropriate, especially when it was resolved at that time. And my client wasn't anticipating future litigation 30 years later regarding a indeterminate commitment in resolving those. So he wasn't, I think this would go into the issue of the negative inferences that the district court was making consistently throughout his order, because my client chose not to testify. Basically,
so counsel, are you indicating then that this court is bound by only the plea entered in at the time of the conviction and no other information?
I think the other information would have to be assessed to be determined as, in fact, clear and convincing evidence to be proceeded upon. And so just...
I didn't mean to interrupt. Go ahead, counsel.
Yeah, so clear and convincing evidence. A police report, is that clear and convincing evidence? Is a charging document clear and convincing evidence? They're resolved without sexual motivations being present in the actual, for instance, in the 2000 conviction that actually went to trial, the court assessed the evidence and determined that the sexual crime that was alleged didn't in fact meet the standard to be a conviction. It was dismissed, essentially. And so do we then go and say, all right, didn't meet beyond a reasonable doubt for a criminal case, but we can then just kind of copy and paste all of that information for purposes of a civil commitment?
And counsel, that I'm glad you brought this up, because I do see this whole negative inference being a challenging issue, because you're right, this is a civil matter, not a criminal one, but I understand your point. This is a very different type of civil matter. So my question is, was there an objection at trial to the use of these negative inferences?
It's my understanding that at trial, the court didn't make these negative inferences, that was in fact made in the court order itself.
I thought at trial that your client agreed that he understood that a consequence of not testifying was that the court can then take these negative to take adverse inferences into account. Am I wrong about that?
That is my understanding, that the my client did choose not to. He knowingly chose not to testify, so that, yes, there would be the potential for negative inferences. But my argument would be these negative inferences, to be used as clear and convincing evidence, I believe, fails to meet that standard.
Why? Why isn't an adverse inference insufficient to meet clear and convincing evidence standard? Is there case law to support that, or some other basis for your assertion?
My argument would be that the removal, the time, the 30 years essentially from a proceeding and a conviction, and to not testify regarding all the specifics relating to that proceeding, would, as a matter of course, fail to meet clear and convincing evidence. And I don't have an authority on the top of my head.
So I want to go back to a discussion we were having earlier about the harmful nature of the conduct and what evidence is necessary. So I'm going to read from subdivision 8 of 253D.02, the definitions provisions. Harmful sexual conduct means sexual conduct that creates not emotional harm. It creates a substantial likelihood of emotional harm. So given that definition, I appreciate that you've acknowledged you don't have any authority to support the idea that you need something more than the record, that you have to have some individual fact finding. But given that definition, I'm trying to get a sense of why your theory actually would prevail just on the plain language, that the district court is only looking for sexual conduct that creates a substantial likelihood of emotional harm to another. Isn't that what happened here? There was testimony from the psychologist that there's a substantial likelihood of emotional harm.
I don't contest that both the examiners testified to that.
So why doesn't their testimony meet the statutory definition without needing to go through and bring in each one of the guards and find out whether they were actually emotionally harmed, if that's the standard?
I think my argument has been that because of the 30 years or so removed from those incidents, they're basically reading back into these incidents, looking back now, hindsight, after the one crim sex conviction, now everything is...
No, I'm talking about the behavior that occurred in the prison. So you've acknowledged there's sufficient evidence that the conduct occurred, that this was in fact a course of sexual conduct, and you're challenging only the harm element. But as I read the statute, the harm element requires evidence of clear and convincing evidence that the conduct doesn't, not that it created harm, but it created a substantial likelihood of emotional harm to another.
What I would challenge would be the specific circumstances leading to potentially the exposure. Was he intending the exposure or not? And I think that's a question of fact that we don't know exactly how that process was.
But you think the record would the record would support the idea that it wasn't intentional exposure, that he was, that when he presented his penis and masturbated in front of these different female guards, it might have been an accident?
That would certainly be my contention.
All right. I think your time's expired. Well, I'm sorry, Judge Justin, you have another question.
Could I just ask counsel to perhaps address something on rebuttal, given that his time is out now? And that is, you know, if we accept your argument that we've really are limited to where there are convictions for criminal sexual conduct, do we have to overturn Stone and I think the Crosby case? So if you would address that on rebuttal, I would appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr. Knuckles. Let me pause you for a second. Forgot to silence my phone and my wife is calling. So I'm... counsel, your time has expired. You will have an additional 5 minutes to use on rebuttal. Before you begin, counsel, for respondent, I'll just give you both an anecdote. When we were in court one day, one of the lawyer's phones went off, and I was presiding, and I was about to caution the lawyer and scold him for leaving his phone on, but I didn't. And then about 30 seconds later, Judge Randy Peterson, who's off to my right, had his phone go off, and it played the most ridiculous song for anyway, so I apologize. I didn't have my phone off. Counsel for, if you could, counsel for appellant, just bear in mind the question that Judge Jessen asked, and if you can think about it so you can respond during your time of rebuttal. Counsel for respondent, you have the floor. Whoops, it doesn't look like you're muted, but I don't hear you. I don't know if any of the other. Okay.
Are you hear me now, Your Honor?
Now we can hear you. Thank you.
I apologize for that.
No, it's in the nature of the technology.
May it please the court, opposing counsel, my name is Jim Osted. I'm here on behalf of the respondent today. Judge Jessen, the last question that you asked, you mentioned In re Crosby. And one thing that I would highlight for the court is that In re Crosby actually stands for the proposition that with regards to the habitual course, that the harmfulness standard does not need to be met. Because it goes to the sexual nature of all the events that were occurring in the prison. And specifically, the court recalls, in addition to the exposure incidents, there were also some stalking incidents. And if we're talking about the substantial likelihood of harmfulness that appellant caused, we had guards that transferred out of prisons, out of the areas they were assigned to work in because of his behaviors, such as sending love notes, mentioning, asking about if the child that one of them was carrying happened to be his. One of the things that stands out in this case, Your Honors, is that whether it was by physical force or isolating individuals that didn't have a choice, in a sense, you have to go to work every day. These female guards didn't have the option not to observe him masturbating. Looking at the sheer number, but actually, all of the incidents were female guards. That stands out given that, at least anecdotally, most of the guards in the Department of Corrections tend to be male. How is it that on nearly a yearly basis following his departure from Oak Park Heights, he managed to expose himself while a female guard happened to be working? What stands out in this case is
we don't know from this record, do we, that he didn't also engage in similar behavior in front of male guards, but just simply wasn't charged with misconduct for that.
It's certainly a situation where, much like crime, sex crimes, anything else, you're correct, Your Honor. There's probably guards that chose not to report it. In fact, there's probably many additional incidents that occurred, but we don't know that. What we do know is that he was written up and found to have masturbated or exposed himself in front of female guards on at least 12 occasions.
No, my point is, I suppose in theory, it's possible that the jail would have a policy of sexualized behavior that's intended to be intimidating, provocative, if it's performed before, if it's a male performing before a female, but perhaps not before a male. And I'm just wondering whether that might be a reason why we have only females listed, that there wasn't a misconduct charge. And maybe it's not implausible, I suppose, that that he engaged in this conduct all the time. It just was only reported when it was a female guard. Can you address that possibility?
I think that certainly is a possibility, Your Honor. If the court does want to look at it, PREA law, the Federal Prisoner Rape Reduction Act, I think I'm getting my acronym incorrect here, but PREA, P-R-E-A, does talk. There's actually, I think this is addressed in the findings or was brought up at trial. Whenever there's a female guard on duty or a male guard on duty in a prison where it'd be the different gender for most of the inmates, there's a bell that goes off. So when a guard comes on at 2 in the morning and the guard happens to be female, there's a bell that goes off to alert all the prisoners because they do have what Mr. Fairbanks referred to as his private time, where they would be allowed to do such things, but there's a bell or a notification that goes off within the prisons.
Do we know that was in, that process was in place in the prison system when Mr. Fairbanks engaged in this behavior? And the record,
Your Honor,
record tell us that?
I cannot speak to when that started occurring as far as the matter of policy goes. But I know it is mentioned. I believe in two of the reports, the guard, and although they're reports that they submit for the misconduct or the violation are really pretty short, they do mention, at least two of them, I believe, mentioned that they sounded the bell to alert that there would be a female guard in their presence doing the head count.
If all we had in this case was the first degree, the conviction for first degree sexual misconduct and the masturbation events in the prison, would that be sufficient for to establish a harmful course of harmful sexual conduct?
It would be, Your Honor. It took a moment to think about that. I think what's significant here is how deep the trial court went into its analysis. For instance, regarding the 1988 federal conviction of the assault, despite the fact that appellant was found around 2:30 in the morning in a bedroom alone with a female that he says was his cousin and that he was in a blackout, he stabs her. A young daughter comes down the hallway, turns on the light, and stabs her. The court found that there wasn't enough evidence to indicate that there was a sexual motivation. The court really did do an in-depth analysis of each of the events. I think that I would submit that the 1992 conviction very clearly has sexual motivation written all over it. When he stops a young girl on the road, hey, you want something to drink? He wants to go out with her. He asks what she's holding. She maces him. He stabs her, follows her to the house, and it's only there that her older sister says to him that she's just a young girl, leave her alone, and then stabs her again, the victim, collapsing her lung.
Counsel, as it relates to that 1992 incident, it seems to me that counsel is arguing that in his plea, he only pled to the assault, and there's nothing within the plea in which he admits to any of these facts. Absent that information from the plea, what is your position as it relates to how can the court get to clear and convincing evidence that this is sexually motivated with the other collateral information, whether it's police reports or other things?
I think, Your Honor, that if the court wants to look at the various records involving his therapy, where he discusses the issues about the women involved in his life, what stands out regarding the appellant's words about the 1992 conviction, were that he talks about his girlfriend, there was a female judge, female judge ordered him not to have any contact with her any longer. But if we're just looking for another conviction, Your Honor, jumping forward to the 2001, 2002, what happened when he was in Anoka County, where he kidnapped the prison guard, J.H.O. The probable cause decision really stands out. The appellant originally challenged on a PC basis whether there was enough to charge him with the attempted Crimsex 1. The court ultimately found that the state didn't establish that beyond a reasonable doubt. However, after knocking J.H.O. unconscious, there's not a lot of good explanation considering that appellant even states that he knew where all the cameras were, that he would take her unconscious, just off camera for 3 to 4 minutes. And when they're back on camera, her pants are down and his pants are.
We know the facts of that, but what we've got is, so we know as a matter of the law of the case or stare decisis or res judicata, however you want to consider it, we know that there was probable cause. We also know that there was not proof beyond a reasonable doubt. But in this case, somewhere in the middle, we have to have clear and convincing evidence. So higher above probable cause is preponderance, and above preponderance is clear and convincing evidence. What would be the basis for the district court in this case to reach the conclusion that clear and convincing evidence of the sexual nature of that, that there was basis for a determination that this was sexual conduct?
Ultimately, Your Honor, I would defer to the trial court's findings on this issue and conclusion of law.
We know what the court found. I'm just trying to get a sense of it. We know there's enough there for probable cause. We know there wasn't enough there for proof beyond a reasonable doubt. And you would have us conclude that there was enough for clear and convincing evidence to establish that element. And I'm trying to get a sense of why do you believe the district court had a basis for that level of reaching the standard of proof based upon the evidence presented?
Your Honor, myself, I come from a criminal background or criminal defense prosecution background. What stands out to me is why was JHO's blood found on his underwear? If we're trying to link up something from a forensic standard looking at sexual intent. The trial court's findings, I think, hit it dead on. While I appreciate that the district court in Anoka made the decision that it wasn't proven beyond a reasonable doubt, it was essentially because there was no semen identified by the BCA scientists.
I mean, I understand all that. I understand the circumstantial evidence standard and why the district court reached its conclusion in the criminal case. I'm just trying to understand how the district court in this case can go from probable cause to clear and convincing evidence on the same record that wasn't sufficient for proof beyond a reasonable doubt. How do you get the next couple of rungs on the standard of proof levels? You've got preponderance, you've got beyond that clear and convincing evidence. How do we get there? How do we affirm the district court's decision on clear and convincing evidence?
Well, Your Honor, I think that the court, or this court already in its questioning, has really identified, looking at the totality of the appellant's life experiences, including the time that he's been incarcerated, just looking at the sexual intent, his Dr. Reitman and Dr. Keller both testified to during the trial. Mr. Fairbanks exhibits a gratuitous and extreme and unnecessary level of violence that is intertwined with his sexual motivations and proclivities. So even ignoring what he ultimately pled guilty to, if the court wants to, Judge Jessen was correct, or I'm not sure which judge asked the question, but Appellant was warned and a record was made about his choice, essentially, not to testify. The state did not ask the court to essentially force him to testify or direct him to testify. He's demonstrated for a very long time that he will not address or he will not honestly address all of his sexual motivations. If the court wants to, I actually don't think the adverse inferences that Judge Shimon did identify throughout his findings are necessary at all to establish if there was a course of harmful sexual conduct or a habitual course. However, that is certainly within Judge Shimon's not only right to do, that is part of the process that is correct. And it's well established that adverse inferences can be used when somebody chooses not to speak up and provide additional information.
If I may, since our time is limited, I mean, and that is one of the things that's a bit troubling about the use, extensive use of adverse inferences here, because this is not your typical civil case, right? That's why we have this higher standard of proof in these civil commitment cases. And we don't have any precedent directly dealing with adverse inferences, do we?
Not that I'm aware of, Your Honor, and that's why I did not cite to it.
Okay, and that's why I asked my question of counsel. Was there an objection made? Was this addressed? Was this raised below? So, I take it from your perspective, there was not an objection.
There was not, Your Honor. In fact, the transcript lays that out very clearly. We made a record of it. We discussed it ahead of time. I was informed by appellant's trial counsel that he was intending not to respond to any questions asked and that he would not be testifying. And so based on a long history of precedent, both here and in the U.S. Supreme Court, in a civil matter, if a witness or a party chooses not to testify or to answer questions, the court is allowed to make an adverse inference. I do see that my time is up. I am happy to answer any additional questions the court has, or I'll be finished. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. It doesn't appear that either of my colleagues has any additional questions, and I certainly don't. So thank you for your argument, and we'll pass back to appellant for rebuttal. You have 5 minutes if you'd like to use that time.
Your Honors, just to address the two issues regarding the Stone case and the Crosby case, I would just make the distinction that in the Stone case, I don't think there was much of an issue as to the sexual nature of the event, of the incidents. Specifically, the first incident was, I believe, first and second degree crim sex. And the second one regarding the child KMT, that was ending up to be a fifth degree crim sex case, and therefore didn't have the presumption, but I don't think the sexual nature of that contact or the incident was the dispute there. And then regarding the Crosby case, leading up to the plea agreement in 1983, there were several different offenses leading up to that the appellant essentially had acknowledged, just attacking various young girls, involving sexual contact with them. And so that although the plea agreement in 1983 didn't prevent the later filing of a commitment petition regarding additional information that was then, or additional incidents beyond what was present at the time of that plea agreement, that didn't preclude the state from proceeding on an indeterminate commitment against him. Thank you.
Thank you. You have a little bit of time left, but it doesn't appear that either of my colleagues has any further questions. And thank you, Mr. Knuckles, Mr. Ostad, for your briefing and your oral argument today. We appreciate the effort you've put into this. It's a serious matter. We will take it under advisement. It is submitted, and we'll issue our opinion within the statutory period. So thank you both, and have a good day.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you.